Don Johnson has been here before. He happens to be one of those people that has two PhDs in science, not just one, but two. And they fit together very well because he's written a number of books. You'll find some on his table in the middle there. One is The Programming of Life. And he talks about the complex programs and information in our cells, which shows us that that was designed. It could not happen by chance. And he presented on that last time. This time we asked him to talk about, well, what is the difference between species and kind? You know, species is a word used by evolutionists. Kind is a word used in the Bible. And if you read Genesis chapter 1, you'll see that word kinds used 10 times. Did God create kinds separately? I think he meant it, mentioned it 10 times. And so he's going to explain the difference between those two. And to start out, he's going to remind us that when people use the terms microevolution and macroevolution, they're a very, very different thing. When you think Darwinian evolution, you need to think about macroevolution, not microevolution. So he'll talk about that and just some of his accomplishments. He's got two websites. One is 4IM, and that is his Christian website. And the other is scienceintegrity.org. He and I, both as scientists, we're very concerned that some so-called scientists are hijacking the definition of science for their agenda. That goes for evolution, that goes for global warming. And so we speak out on those kinds of things, and Don will mention some of that as well. So Don, come on up. Let's welcome him.
All scientists, hello, are you here? Yeah, it's proven, it works. It's small scale genetic changes that are inheritable. That's called microevolution. Macroevolution is what is commonly known as Darwinian evolution, and that is that all life is descended from a single organism in which life originally developed, and everything else split off from that, and we'll look at that scenario. That has never been observed, but 77% of people accept that as truth. And so we'll look at what evidence there is for that. Cornelius Hunter said, all of our data suggest that small-scale evolution cannot produce the sort of large-scale changes that Darwinism requires. And Roger Lewin said at a conference on evolution, said the central question whether the mechanisms underlying microevolution can be extrapolated to explain the phenomenon of macroevolution, the answer can be given as a clear no. So people in science acknowledge that that is the case. But yet scientists all over the place accept that as truth, and which just basically goes to say what the Bible says, although they claim to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal human beings and birds and animals and reptiles. They claim to be really smart, but yet God didn't create us. It was the slime becoming reptiles, becoming birds, becoming monkeys, becoming man. That's what created us. And I don't have to call them fools because God does. They claim to be wise, but God says differently. A kind is not a scientific term, so it's kind of hard to talk about that with scientists, but it has multiple species are involved with a kind. The species, for example, has 26 different definitions of species. The most common one is a species is a set of beings that can reproduce itself. For example, a mule can't reproduce, therefore it's not a species. A donkey and a horse can produce a mule, but a mule itself is not a species. A breed or a fraction has different attributes. There are lots of breeds of dogs, breeds of horses. All of Darwin's finches that he used to say Galapagos Islands there, that the Darwin's finches that were used for years to prove evolution is true, they're all one species. You did not have finches developing into other species. They were all finches. They could interbreed. They had different beak sizes and things based on their diet and the things that they were involved with, but they were all the same species. Dogs, for example, the household dogs, are all one subspecies, Canis lupus familiaris. And theoretically, all dogs could interbreed because they're all the same species. Now, it might be kind of painful to think about some of them interbreeding, but but nonetheless, they could, theoretically. But a created kind, as originally used, can have all of the genetic information that is needed for the differing species of that kind. So that, for example, the kinds that we have here, we have a canine kind up here, wolf and dog and coyote and all kinds of other things that you could envision that would fit into the canine kind. They could easily descend from that one kind. Cats, the feline kind, would have the house cat and mountain lion and bobcat and pumas and anything else that you can think of, cheetahs. The equine kind would include things like zebras and donkeys and horses, and it would include the mule in that kind, but the mule is not a species because it cannot reproduce. Got the difference? Kind of? So there are lots of different things that are shared by the same kind. And the idea is that when God created a kind, he inserted into the DNA of that kind everything that would be needed to make animals of that kind. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a little bit. So if you look at the biological tree of life that was supposed to show evolution, this is the biological tree of life, where at the very beginning, left-hand side here, you don't have to read all this, by the way, because it's in Latin. the original organism which produced life, and there's no viable mechanism for doing that, but that split off and forms a whole bunch of other things, and eventually they split many times, and here we have modern-day organisms at the very end. What's very interesting to me on this picture is that the dark areas of this plot show fossils that have been found. The light areas, like here for example, those are the presumed interconnections. Now, do you notice anything interesting about that plot? What happens with in the black areas? You have an organism appears rather suddenly and then stays that way until modern time or until it goes extinct. But you don't see the black areas along the presumed interconnections between species. Follow that? So those are all presumed because obviously they exist, and this therefore, and they must have come from the original organism here somehow, and the only way to do that is by the transition between species. But there's no evidence for it. That's the whole point. And Darwin acknowledged that as well, that the evidence is completely missing. Most of the animal phyla that are represented in the fossil record appear fully formed in the Cambrian. That's the lowest level. The fossil record is therefore no help with respect to the origin and early diversification of the various animal phyla. So says the authors Barnes, Clough, and Olive. Richard Dawkins, famous evolutionist, says concerning the invertebrates, it's as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history, so that they just suddenly appeared with no evolutionary history. But they must have had an evolutionary history, but we just can't see it. Anyway, the fossil record really supports the creation because you have multiple life in the oldest fossil-bearing rocks. For example, the Cambrian is the oldest fossil-bearing rocks. And the species are fixed over time. Once they appear, they stay that way. They don't change dramatically from one to another. There have been no verified transitional forms, although many have been claimed. For example, we'll take a look at one example of the transitional form of the tectolic. But turns out that's not the case. Anyway, the created kinds, Barominology is that what we talked about before, that a particular kind can develop into multiple different species through minor modifications that are built into the genetic code. So in the creation model, what we have actually is a creation orchard. The created kinds are at the lowest level. They can split off into multiple species above that. As opposed to the evolutionary tree, you had one organism that was formed initially. That split off multiple times into everything that we see. So that's the big difference between evolution and kinds. There's a very interesting, intriguing video called What Darwin Never Knew. It's a 2-hour PBS video. It's available online as well. And what's intrigued me about it is that except for a minor gene mutation that caused a mouse color of a mouse hair to change, that's at minute 39, all of the evidence for the evolution that was presented involved turning on or off pre-existing genes. It did not involve creation of anything new. They already were there, and it simply turned them on or off. And in this video, they were looking for the transitional form that should have been between fish and four-limbed creatures, tetrapods. And when they found a fossil of Dactylic, they said, this is it. That proves evolution is true. That's what they say in the video that's still up online. That proves that was the transitional form between fish and tetrapods. It proved it, according to the video at least, because the genes that were needed to make arms and legs out of fins were already being carried around by this prehistoric fish. That's what the video says. But what's interesting is that a couple of years after that was found, a fully formed tetrapod was found in layers that were 10 million years older than Tiktaalik. So Tiktaalik could not have been a transition between fish and tetrapods because a fully formed tetrapod was older. You got that picture? And what was interesting also from this video is that the information that was presented in the video, one could conclude that the very first life on the evolutionary tree was created with all genes that were ever possible to need on all life, and that all life involved just switching on or off those genes. And it had no explanation of where the information for all those genes came from. And anyway, this is a video.
Tiktaalik is a perfect transitional form. Much of its body is that of a fish. It's covered in scales. But it also had something very unfish-like. An arm-like fin, or perhaps a fin-like arm.
Anyway, Tiktaalik in the evolutionary model fits right here. I don't know if you ever heard about the coelacanth. That's a fish, but supposedly these prehistoric fish developed into a lobed fin fish with arms, fin-like arms, developed into an amphibian, and it could walk on land. Well, today we have walking catfish and stuff like that that are kind of similar in characteristics. But they declared that to be the perfect transitional form that proved evolution because they were looking for it and they found it. And then, like I said, a couple of years after they found it, a fully formed tetrapod was formed that demolished that scenario. But the video is still online. The coelacanth fish is very interesting because that, anytime you found a rock with a coelacanth fossil in it, it dated that rock as being 70 million years old because that's when coelacanths lived. Sounds reasonable. So it was an index fossil. Any rock that had a coelacanth fossil was dated at 70 million years because that's when coelacanths lived. That kind of changed, though, in 1939 when they caught a live coelacanth off the coast of Madagascar. And that kind of blew their theory. Anyway, I don't know how many of you know about the second law of thermodynamics, but it says entropy always increases. Things get more and more disorganized. They tend to be randomly scattered. and it requires directed energy to have an isolated entropy decrease. Living organisms are rich in energy, but yet evolution actually requires a decrease in entropy, which goes against the second law of thermodynamics, which is interesting. Bible said the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay, which is basically disorganization and rusting and rotting and so forth. In the beginning you laid the foundations, they will perish, they will wear out like a garment. So entropy is something that's very important to a person who's into science, at least. Some of you may not have realized, if you didn't hear my previous talk, that there are real computers in everything that's alive. And I point out in my Programming of Life book that every single cell of the 100 to 300 trillion cells of your body has literally millions of real computers and real computer programs. And, well, they're not. People have said to me, those aren't computers, those are just chemicals. I point out, this electronic computer is just chemicals too. That's not what makes it a computer. What makes it a computer is it fills the category of the necessary and sufficient requirements that it has input or embedded data, has memory, it has data transfer within it, it has an instantiated program that it can be read and processed, and it has the processing capability to do it and produce meaningful output. That's what makes it a computer. And there are millions of computers in every single cell. For example, DNA and RNA can store programs to be executed, and proteins and cellular controls and outputs. Proteins can communicate with other components of the cell. What I've stated multiple times in peer-reviewed papers is that biology is an information science, not a physical science, because everything in biology is controlled by the flow of information that control the physics and chemistry that are involved with the life. So it's not just complex organic chemistry. Got that picture? That everything in life that makes it life is controlled by the processing of digital information by real computers. And Craig Venter verified experimentally the reality of computers in life. One of the things that's not usually considered is that there are mutations that happen with living organisms. For example, on average, a newborn human being is born with 60 harmful mutations. Ooh, that sounds like a lot. Well, 60 out of 6 billion is not all that many. Okay, so the chances are pretty good the newborn will survive. However, if there are mutations in the genetic code, they will be passed on to their offspring. And each offspring will also not only pass on the inherited 60 from the parent, but it will create 60 new ones for its offspring. And therefore, the fitness is going to decrease by about 1 to 2% per generation, and we're going to go extinct in less than 10,000 years. Just by what we know about the mutations and the buildup of harmful mutations in the genome. There's an interesting paper in the Journal of Theoretical Biology called Why Have We Not Died 100 Times Over? Which is a really good question. If human beings have been around for as long as people say they have, we should not be here at all. Each mutation causes a guaranteed net information loss, not an information gain, because it changes the prescriptive programs that are in the DNA. Even Richard Dawkins admits mutation is not an increase in true information, rather the reverse. So Richard Dawkins even admits that mutation is an information loss, not an information gain. So when Richard Dawkins says evolution is random mutation followed by natural selection, what he said is that these information losses can produce new species that are better. I kind of doubt that. Anyway, he created a program that he used to illustrate how evolution works. It was a program that took this random string of characters, and on the 43rd try, it produced Shakespeare's "Methinks it is like a weasel." Well, that sounds pretty impressive. Randomly changing things in only 43 tries, it produced "Methinks it is like a weasel." Until you realize what he did. He knew the goal in advance, so any time a letter appeared where it was supposed to be, he didn't mutate it anymore. What this really proves is that a programmer who knows what he's after can program something to produce results. That's what that proves. It doesn't prove evolution at all. So everywhere in the apparatus and the genetic algorithms appear the scientist's fingerprints. These algorithms prove what they aim to refute, the need for intelligence and targets in any creative process. So that really didn't prove anything concerning evolution. Neo-Darwinian biology says that each successive change in the gradual evolutionary process was simple enough relative to its predecessor to have arisen by chance. That's what Richard Dawkins says. That's Neo-Darwinian biology. Charles Darwin said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Remember that. Darwin said, if anything that is in existence could not be formed by slight modifications, his theory doesn't work. We'll look at a couple of those. Orrin Coyne said, we conclude unexpectedly that there is little evidence for the neo-Darwinian view. Its theoretical foundations and experimental evidence supporting it are weak. And then one of my favorites, the failure to observe even one mutation that adds information is more than just a failure to support the theory, it is evidence against the neo-Darwinian theory. There has never been ever a case that was but documented of the net functional information increasing by a random mutation, ever. A couple of things that are very interesting. In the very lowest fossil level, in the Cambrian, there are trilobite fossils. The interesting thing about a trilobite are the eyes of the trilobite, because the eyes of a trilobite consist of calcium carbonate, an inorganic focusing material, and the only other animal to use inorganic focusing material is man with glasses. That's the only other one. But anyway, couple of things about it. They knew all, apparently these trilobites that lived supposedly 500 million years ago knew all of the laws of physics and so forth that allowed them to do this. But the lenses optimize both light collecting and image formation better than any lens that optical physics has ever been able to formulate. Not only just as good as, they're better. And what's interesting also is because they're inorganic material, they're not biological, they don't decay, physicists can actually measure the actual properties of those lenses because they're there, and they can measure them and make all kinds of interesting things. For example, the design of the trilobite's eye lens could well qualify for a patent disclosure. They're that good. And these things are in the very lowest level with no predecessors involved in their below them, because they're at the lowest level. Anyway, so one wonders, going back to Darwin's statement, if anything could be shown that couldn't have arisen by small natural processes, his theory fails. One of my favorites, and this has been used a lot, is the bacterial flagellum. At the end of a lot of bacteria are a flagellum that is powered by a rotary electric motor that spins at several thousand revolutions per minute and powers the bacterium through a solution as it's in search of food or prey. But it's an electric motor. It has all the components of an electric motor. It has rotor and stator and bushings and all the other things that electric motors have, but it's extremely small in this one-cell organism called a bacterium. It's really tiny. Can't even see it. But what's really interesting also is that the flagellum is made up of 48 different proteins. And as an information scientist, every one of those proteins is an output of the execution of a real computer program. So you have 48 computer programs that are used to make the components of the flagellum. And there is no explanation for that arising by small step-by-step degradations. Because if you take any one of those 48 proteins away, the thing does not work at all. It has no functionality. So it cannot function with one of those proteins missing. That's known as irreducibly complex. It's very complex. Take one part away and it doesn't work at all. It's irreducibly complex. And Mike Behe wrote about this kind of thing. Now, the probability of forming just 30 of those proteins by random processes is one part in 5,250. That's a 1 followed by 5,250 zeros. There's a 1 followed by 80 zeros atoms in the entire universe. That number is tiny. And that's the probability that all of those proteins would be formed at once. So if we look at Darwinism, the complexity of biology has seemed to grow by orders of magnitude. Biology's new glimpse of a universe of non-coding DNA has been fascinating and befuddling. Non-coding DNA, 98%, a little over 98% of the DNA does not code proteins. And in the early 70s, starting in 1970, it started to be known as junk DNA because it didn't code for proteins. It's worthless, junk. And so for over 30 years, it was declared to be junk. And the signaling information in cells, though, shows that it's organized in networks of information. It's infinitely more complex than ever, than people could even imagine. But anyway, the less than 2% was protein coding. The rest was junk. And Richard Dawkins, our favorite evolutionist, said, "Creationists might spend some earnest time speculating on why the creator should bother to litter genomes with untranslated pseudogenes and junk tandem repeat DNA. So he said in 2004. He should have known better by then, but he didn't. He was deriding creationists for believing in a creator because no reasonable creator would create DNA with all that junk, useless stuff in it. That was his view. Well, there was a series of studies that were done that resulted in 30 papers that were published in the fall of 2012 that showed known function for over 80% of this junk DNA. It's not junk. Over 80% at that time was proved to be functional, and a lot more has been proved to be functional since then, because papers keep coming out all the time. So it is not junk. God don't make junk. Anyway. And Darwinism is now being doubted by literally thousands of scientists. Karl Popper, who made the falsifiable, in science you have to have something that's falsifiable. In other words, you have to be able to show what would it take to show that this is wrong. If you can't come up with something that will show it's wrong, then it's not science. But anyway, he said, Darwinism is not a testable scientific theory, but a metaphysical research program. Bruce Reniger said, natural selection is not a mechanism, it's the process by which the results of evolution are sorted. Natural selection just describes which ones are going to reproduce. And what I've pointed out in my books, for example, natural selection is not and cannot be a mechanism for evolution, because natural selection has no mechanism for going into the genome and modifying it. That's where evolution supposedly occurs, in the genetic code. Natural selection just says, well, this is an existing organism, it is surviving, and it can reproduce. It has no mechanism for changing the genetic code. Therefore, it cannot be a mechanism for evolution. Stunningly, information has been shown not to increase in the coding regions of DNA with evolution. Mutations do not produce an increase in information. The amount of coding in DNA actually decreases with in evolution. And even Dawkins admits that. We must concede there are presently no detailed Darwinian accounts of evolution of any biochemical or cellular system, only a handful of wishful speculations. But there's a lot of that. Remember, Darwinism actually says the mutations take place by random mutations in the genetic code. And what that really says is you have these existing computer programs in the genome, and you could make random changes to those programs and sometimes produce better programs. That happens all the time in computer science. Sure it does. Anyway, there's been a whole bunch of things. This was from a paper published in 2014. Does evolutionary theory need a rethink? Yes, urgently. And this was published in Nature. The number of biologists calling for a change is now on how evolution is conceptualized is growing rapidly. But yet, the mere mention of the extended evolutionary synthesis often evokes an emotional, even hostile reaction among the evolutionary biologists. They cannot stand, oh, you're toying with our pet thing here. And, you know, it doesn't matter that thousands of scientists are abandoning Darwinism. It can't be abandoned because it's got to be true. Well, there have been a whole bunch of things. There was a paper last month that says why an extended evolutionary synthesis is necessary. This is a whole month old here now. The rising number of publications argue for a major revision or even a replacement of the standard theory of evolution, indicating that this cannot be dismissed as a minority view, but rather as a widespread feeling among scientists and philosophers alike. And I talked about this extensively in my Programming of Life book, that I said in the next edition, it may be very well that I would be relegating Darwinism as a historic footnote, because it cannot stand. It really can't. Anyway, so hopefully the number of scientists that are coming out and saying we really need a change and we need to look at something different is growing and growing and growing, so that thousands of scientists are now doubting the evolutionary scenario as proposed by Darwinism. So anyway, a couple of the examples. Evolution by natural genetic engineering. Genetic engineering is when you take the genome and you modify it to produce the results that you want in the organism that's being produced. Now, natural genetic engineering says that molecular cell biology has revealed an information processing network. One of the traditional objections to Darwinian gradualism is that it has been too slow and indeterminate a process to account for the natural adaptions, even allowing for long periods of time of random mutation. Natural genetic engineering employs a combinatorial search. Ooh. What's a combinatorial search? In computer science, a combinatorial search searches every possible way for a solution until it finds one, then it chooses that solution. Now, what Shapiro is saying here is a cell has the intelligence to make a search of which process, which mutation would be most beneficial before the mutation happens. It's not random mutation followed by natural selection. It's which of the mutations that I could make would be most beneficial, and I'll choose that one. You get the difference? So that says the cell has the intelligence to make a decision as to which mutation I should perform. Little different than Darwinism. Anyway, such a cognitive component, the cell has a mind that can make decisions, is absent from traditional evolutionary theory because 19th and 20th century evolutionists were not sufficiently knowledgeable by cellular response and control networks. I find that one to be really interesting, to put it mildly. And there have been conferences on that, and this is one of the leading contenders for the extended evolutionary synthesis. That, well, somehow changes happen, and we know that randomness can't produce those changes. Therefore, the cell must have the intelligence to choose ahead of time which way to mutate. There are a couple more that are kind of interesting. Evolution, and all of these fit into the extended synthesis, which involves a whole bunch of different categories. We know Darwinism doesn't work, so let's throw a whole bunch of other things at it to see which ones stick. And basically, we have to come up with some kind of a natural scenario that's purely natural, doesn't involve any supernatural or anything, that will work. And the natural genetic engineering would work if it were true. But even if it did work, who put the capability into those cells to make those kinds of decisions? Anyway, horizontal gene transfer. This is another biggie for creating new organisms. What it says is that the genetic code the gene from one organism gets transferred into a different organism. Okay? So that new organism now has the same part of the genetic code that was in the previous, the donor gene. And Carl Woese says, how could modern biology have gone so badly off track? It's a simple tale of scientific complacency. Biologists were seduced by their own success into thinking they had found the final truth about all evolution. And he believes that they missed the truth because it's really by horizontal gene transfer. That's just one of the ways. And I point out in my book, and also on this slide, horizontal gene transfer doesn't violate any information principles, because you can transfer information all kinds of different ways. I can put a USB drive in here. I can transfer information here to a printed page. I can transfer it over the internet. That doesn't create any new information, though. All it does is transfer the information. So horizontal gene transfer doesn't generate any new information. So it's not a mechanism for generating anything novel. The other thing that's kind of similar to that, and that's within the gene, there's something called jumping genes, where portions of the gene can move from one part of the gene to a different part of the genetic code, to a different part of the genome, and in an apparent jump. They're called transposable elements, and they're found up in a lot of different places. They're 80% of the maize genome has it, nearly 50% of the human genome has transposable elements. In other words, there are elements in the genome that you can move to somewhere else. But realize that does not create any new information. All it does is move the information to a different place. And it can produce a little different result, but it doesn't create anything, any information that's new. What I point out in my book, for example, science really needs some scientific explanations to explain some plausible mechanisms as to how did nature write the programs that are needed to organize life's metabolism and formally solve life's other complex problems and write those programs. How did it develop the operating systems and the programming languages to carry those things out? There's no mechanisms for doing that. Those are all intellectual activities by programmers when they do it. How did the cell do it? Well, maybe if the cell had the capabilities that would allow it to do natural genetic engineering, it might maybe could. But anyway, how did the arbitrary protocols develop for communicating and processing the data between the millions of computers in every single cell? There's no explanation how those things can develop. Those, again, require mind. They're not something that just happens. There are all kinds of alternative messaging systems, multi-level encryption. Some of the nucleotides along the genome have been found to be in as many as 12 different programs. You can envision what it would take to have a 12-dimensional crossword puzzle, pick a one letter that would make sense 12 different ways in 12 different words. And anyway, that's kind of what we're up against here. The other thing as a computer scientist that is hard to explain is how did nature defy computer science principles to avoid software engineering's top-down approach and instead build things from the bottom up? Evolution occurs at the very lowest level. You have these random mutations at the very lowest level that produces extremely complex system at the highest level. How did they do that? never has been observed in computer science, that's for sure. Anyway, how did they have programs that can modify resulting in the irreducibly complex structures? And none of these things have been answered, and all of them require some sort of science explanation in order to accept these things as science. What I'm doing in my book is pointing out, hey, we don't have a scientific answer for this that's answerable by normal science. So there's probably something else. I don't specify what it is in this book, but I know what it is. Anyway, so the conclusion is that the Bible and fossil records show sudden appearances and stasis. Everything is basically the same. Darwinian mechanisms have been disproved. They do not work. Computer life simulations and artificial life are designed. They're not evidences of random mutation followed by natural selection. There is no explanation from natural science to explain the information and the programming that is in life, but rather we are indeed fearfully and wonderfully made, as it says in Psalm 139. But we do have to realize that our knowledge on any subject is limited, because we see but a poor reflection in the mirror, and we're learning more and more all the time. But the proven reliability of the Bible and a lot of these things, like in science, should increase our confidence in the accuracy in things that we don't know about yet, like heaven, hell, and so forth. The world is blind to many truths because they exchange the truth of God for a lie. I have on my website, there are a number of references. I will put the PDF of this talk on my website as well, my Christian website, 4iam.org. You might check that out. That has all kinds of things. It has the flyers that are on the back that can be printed out and distributed as you wish. It has over a dozen and a half video presentations that I've done various places that are viewable from my website. And it has links to the Programming of Life videos as well, so you can view those. Plus a whole bunch of other neat stuff. So anyway.